thank you everyone for coming. It's already been such a great conference, and I'm so excited to have our two distinguished guests with me to have a conversation with all of us. The title of this talk is Believers Look Up. I want to point out there's no comma there. It's not an imperative directive of, like, believers, comma, look up. It's not that. What it is that's been done, right? What it is, and I'm gonna come clean, and I know you're not supposed to say this in polite conversation, but I'm an atheist. I'm also like a very tiny portion of humanity. The vast majority of people are guided by some deeper faith, and that is something that I think science journalists, environmental journalists, from my experience, tend to be leaning more towards the secular side, and I think that there are a lot of missing stories by the fact that environmental journalists are not talking, are recognizing the import of religion in people's lives and covering the stories that bring those things together. So I'm a freelance journalist. I'm also co-director of the Religion and Environment Story Project, which is an endeavor that started with my husband, who's in the back there, Stephen Prothero, who was a religious studies professor. And this really came out of kitchen table conversations of me coming back from the field as an environmental science journalist and talking about how these stories could be so much richer, so much deeper, and the things that I was missing as a science journalist. So I want to give a shout out. Also, we have some art. We have a fellowship. Keep an eye out. There's bookmarks going around so you can get information about the fellowship. We have a few of our fellows here who helped me organize this panel. Give a wave. Luann Huska, Christina Nickel, Brittany Cordera is here, and where is Diana? Is Diana here?
Diana's not here.
Okay, Diana's somewhere at SCJ. Also, I encourage you to refer to the resources list. We have a growing Google document of resources list on the REST website that includes stories that are helping bridge this divide. Resources for you if you're a religion journalist who wants to get more attuned to climate information. If you're a climate journalist who wants to get more attuned to where to step into the religious space. So I encourage you to go to the resource page, check it out, and also send us suggestions if you have ideas for more ways that we can grow that list. So enough about all of that. I want to jump into our conversation because this is a very ambitious scope of this. We want to cover from eco-grief all the way to solutions and what we can really be learning as journalists and finding good stories about how to tap into what religious people are doing right now in this moment. And the eco-grief is really an interesting thing because it's there's kind of two things going on. There's the communal eco-grief that's going on the level of everyone dealing with recognition that the climate crisis is very serious and it's happening now and it's affecting everybody. And there's also us as environmental journalists, which my husband can attest to, me, you know, being a little bit doom and gloom in the house of really trying to process this information as we report on this. So there's kind of two elements going on with the eco-grief that I hope we can touch on. But I just want to give the floor to I'm going to do the briefest of introductions with these two amazing people. You can dig into all of their amazing information. But right beside me, I have Catherine Hayhoe. You probably saw her speaking in the plenary just now about ocean science, and she's got her science down. But she is also the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. She has this incredibly esteemed title at Texas Tech University, and she holds her own fiercely with Jimmy Kimmel on Late Night. And then we have, and she's also the author of Saving Us, which is available at the bookstore, by the way.
Oh, look, I'm home.
And then beside her, we have Bea Moorhead, who for 22 years has been the executive director of Texas Impact. It's based in Austin, and it's interfaith organization working on environmental justice issues, and the largest and oldest legislative interfaith network, if I got that right.
In Texas.
And they are also a branch of Interfaith Power and Light, so I'm just going to give the floor to Catherine. Why don't you talk for a few minutes, but really we're going to jump into a conversation. We're going to have plenty of time for your questions, so start formulating them. Catherine.
All right. Oh, that's really bad. That, no, it's not. That's, is it just here. Mine that's the problem?
Here you go.
Okay, let's try this. Okay, how's that? All right. I mean, it's a smaller room anyways, right? But
So I'm a climate scientist because I'm a Christian. I was planning on being an astrophysicist, publishing papers on galaxy clusters around quasars. I was scoping out future graduate schools when I needed an extra breadth requirement to finish my degree. So I looked around and there was a brand, and it completely changed the trajectory of my life. Not because I learned that climate change was real, I already knew it was, but it was because I'd always thought of it. And in that class, that was where I learned for the first time that it doesn't impact us all equally. People who are already marginalized, people who are already vulnerable, people who already do not have a voice, are impacted by a changing climate, and they're the ones who've done the least to contribute to it. According to one Oxfam study, the 3.5 billion poorest people in the world, which is almost half. So that was what made me decide to become a climate scientist, because it was so urgent and so profoundly unfair, and the people who were most affected often didn't have a voice studying galaxies. That was a very long time ago.
Yes, please.
We have many things in common, including our love of yarn.
Yeah, we're tempted to just...
There is, and I'm totally there for that. To share my faith in the United States, where does denial come from? So often, it is cloaked in religiously sounding arguments. And I'm emphasizing, so what does it matter what humans do? The world's going to end anyway, so why do we care? But when you take evil basis whatsoever in Christian theology or in the theology of any nation, excuses for the real issue. So, first of all, let me just take two of those as a brief example. God's in control, so what we do doesn't matter. Well, first book of the Bible is Genesis. It says God gave humans responsibility over every living thing on this earth. Last book of the Bible, Revelation, it says God will destroy those who destroy the earth. So obviously there's no theology supporting the fact that humans do not. Yeah, that whole idea is one that has completely poisoned society because it's led to this laissez-faire, put your feet up in the lazy boy of life, doesn't matter, there's a big red eject button beside you that you can push when the New Testament was being written. Humans were humans. And there were people who were basically saying, I could just quit my job and sit around because the world's going to end anyways. And the Apostle Paul, what I wouldn't give for that man to be here today, because he would have a few choice things to say to people, I think. And back then, he basically wrote to people and in a nutshell said, get a job. Support your family, care for the poor and the widows. You don't know what's going to happen. Nature and caring for those of us who are less fortunate. That is embedded in every major world religion, and it's embedded in our moral code, no matter who we are as humans. So where does this denial come from then? It comes from solution aversion. We don't want to fix it. Why? Not because of any religious or theological reasons, because of political reasons. We don't want to fix it. But if we say, sure, it's real, all the scientists agree, it's affecting the poorest and most marginalized people in the world, but I don't want to fix it. We don't feel very good about ourselves if we say that. So what we do is our defense mechanisms kick in and we engage in motivated reasoning. We go out and we look, and the internet is happy to help us find reason. It's with government grants. It's been warming before, so why does it matter? What about those countries over there? Who are we to tell them they can't use fossil fuels? They should be able to use them. Like, I have news for you people. The Paris Agreement is voluntary. Nobody's telling anybody what they can or can't use. It's your own country decides what you're bringing to the table. And most of those low-income countries don't have fossil fuel resources. So if you are trying to persuade them to use fossil fuel resources, it's so useless. When I travel, I often engage with Christian communities outside the U.S., and I'm Canadian myself. And when I hear these climate denial arguments, when I hear this window dressing that hides solutions out of 10, I stop and I ask people, where did you hear that? It's in France. 9 out of 10 times I hear, denial is uniquely American phenomena that thinks, why is it that U.S. Christians have fallen into this trap? Because today, 40% of people who self-identify as evangelical in the United States don't go to church. So if they don't go to church, where are they being catechized, so to speak? The churchy word for taught. Where are they being taught what they believe? Facebook, by the church of their social media feed, by the church of whatever media outlet they listen to. That's who they're being taught by. And so today, in the United States, a huge number of people who self-identify as Christian, I'm just saying Christian because that's the dominant religion in the United States, their statement of faith is written primarily by their political ideology. Christian is a political label. And when the two come in conflict, politics and the Bible, they will go with politics over the Bible. I was speaking with an elected representative a few, 6-7 years ago now when the Pope was visiting. He was Catholic, Republican. Very excited about the Pope's visit. Talked all about, you know, the events that were happening and how he'd get to meet the Pope and how his family would get to meet the Pope and how for as a Catholic, you must be really interested in the Pope's encyclical then. Because the encyclical was just coming out. Mm-hmm. With the dinner that we're going to get to go to. So that just shows you, it's all politics. So what do we need to do? I think, and Bea and I have been working in this field for a very long time, we need to hold up a mirror. A person who looked at themselves in the mirror and went away and forgot who you are. Mm-hmm. Now some people never work. Some people just use that label as a political cultural label. But for people who actually believe this but have been led astray by the catechism, so to speak, of our news and media feeds, hold up the mirror and remind people who we are because faith has a lot to bring to the table. What is climate change? What is... And when we love, as it says, love covers a multitude of sins, love means I'm going to look to your needs above mine. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look to who is suffering, and I'm going to do everything I can to alleviate that suffering. I'm not going to, as Bob Bullard said in the plenary below, I'm not going to focus on the word that begins with G and ends with D and has an R-E-E in the middle. Greed. I'm going to focus on the word that begins with G and ends with D and has an O in the middle because we believe God is love. We believe we are to be recognized by our love for others. We believe that our soul pro-identified with the religion that had love at its core, actually were recognized by their love for others. We would be living in a completely
different world.
What can faith bring to the thread that has run through the faith discourse for a long time? And I'm fascinated by people like Hannah Malcolm, who is the granddaughter of Sir John Houghton. Sir John Houghton is a leading climate scientist who led the first and second IPCC reports. Mm-hmm. Who talked, so Hannah grew up around him, including his family, about how the poorest and most vulnerable would be most impacted by climate change. So Hannah grew up listening to her grandfather talk of expressions on climate and eco-grief. People reflecting on it from a faith-based perspective, because if you look at the laments throughout the Bible, and again, other traditions as well, I'm just speaking from my own, the concept of suffering and grief and lament. And so for me, one of the most important aspects of what I believe is that hope does not begin with positive circumstances. You don't need hope when everything is going well. When do you need hope? When suffering. And life is very dark right now. Romans, the book of Romans says, suffering. Character leads to hope. Mm-hmm. And that hope will not disappoint. Why? Because of love. So faith brings these words to the table that are, and words of encouragement, hope, and action. My favorite Bible verse, I'll end with this and then hand it over to Bea to sort of reflect on this, and then we'll take a few questions. But my favorite Bible verse has nothing to do with nature, plants, animals, creation. There's many beautiful... That's the spirit of fear. And if you look at the dialogue around climate change today, it is full of fear. Fear on one side because of the unchecked impacts of climate change. Fear on the other side of solutions that manifest itself in denial and anger. It's all fear underneath. All of it is fear. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but rather a spirit that paralyzes us. We are able to act, spirit of love, out of concern and care and compassion for others, and, as a scientist, my favorite part, a sound mind to make good decisions based on the information that we get, which includes from the science. So I believe faith is an essential part of who I am and what I do, and I believe in everyone bringing who they are to the table because we need every single unique voice speaking from an authentic and genuine place of what we love, who we love, where we love, and bringing all of those who share that with a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. That one thing is a human being living on planet Earth, and every single one of us is that.
Thank you.
prepared to follow.
But you have notes, B. I see your notes.
I do have notes. I have notes because anyone in my position, if they know they're going to be in a room full of people who might write a story about something, always wants to pitch, right? So I will just start by saying, because everyone knows a thing called Texas Impact. So Texas Impact is a state, but the thing that I think is really important for you all is there's an organization like mine that is the councils of churches. Now, today, they're broadly interfaith, usually, but they are organizations that aren't in denominations, but they do. So all of the things that we describe as they're, because of that, they attach to people in Texas don't know that we're working on climate change. And it's implicated organizations like Texas Impact in Ohio, the Ohio Council of Churches, and Ohio Impact, which is a similar organization. And in the United States, of 50 states and the District of Columbia, there are, I believe at this point, 41 interfaith power and network organizations. So almost every state has this IPL, which is the network that was started a number of years ago. That was its original plan, and but we're doing it a different way now, so now it's about advocacy and direct action. So if anybody is interested in an IPL contact in another state, I'm happy to give it to you. I want to respond, I guess, in so many ways. grief and community in the United States, and probably globally, but I won't stray for what I'm not as familiar with. Faith communities in the United States are going through, and only related to COVID. It started before that, and COVID has maybe accelerated some. One of the things that it may be possible, when you say people are getting their information from the church of Facebook, a lot of people who think of themselves as churchgoers now, changes in the way church works, and it is making a lot of people, whether they're in church or synagogue or mosque, so it's a great time to do an activity that Mira and I were talking about. Catherine is very well familiar with. It came to us from the global climate negotiations. It's called Talanoa Dialogue. And Talanoa Dialogue is a process of collaborative community dialogue and discernment that focuses on a thing that is a water planning term, but I love it and I incorporate it into everything. It's desired future conditions. So rather than talking about what's scary right now, what we talk about is, what do we want it to be like in the future? So you can ask, what do you want it to be like in the future about your local community or your congregation or potentially the world and the climate that we all live in? Talanoa Dialogue. We've been doing an exercise on Talanoa Dialogue where we have little Talanoa dialogues with people in local communities to imagine and talk to you about what they want things to be like in the future is magical, I think, because nobody can do it. We're trained to not do that. We're trained to say, you know, if you say, where are we now? People have no to go. So the Talanoa questions are, where are we? Where do we want to go? And how do we get there? And you say, where are we? Nobody's got a problem answering. Where would you like to go? And they say, well, tell me where I don't want to go. Where I don't want to go is the thing. And you say, that's not what I ask. Yeah. That's what you do want it to be like. And it opens up people's hearts in a way that, I'm just constantly shocked at, grown men crying when they get the opportunity to say, what do I want it to be like? Mm-hmm. So if I were, for example, writing a story about Toledo and Flint and that area, I wouldn't say, what are you worried about the Great Lakes? I'd say, what do you want your children? Mm-hmm. When I was in third grade, I went on a ferry tour of Lake Erie to look at the dead fish. I grew up in Cleveland. I grew up in Kent, so 1970s, I'm old. They said, what I want is for people to be able to eat the food out of Lake Erie. And when my husband and I took our children to Lake Erie to visit, we didn't. We ate fish out of is not just a way to have a local conversation. I think it's an orientation to the way we're asking people questions, which is common for everyone. People just don't understand, what am I supposed to be doing? They've lost their ability to have civilized conversations with each other at first. Yeah. Everyone is susceptible, and say one other thing, and then I will, I know we're probably short on time, but when Kappenden's a big global thinker, his name is Adam Kahane, he wrote a book called Solving Tough Problems. Adam Kahane was, he was a engineer with Royal Dutch Shell, and because of his, the opportunities that came to him because of that, he became part of the team of consultants who came in to help the South African stakeholders develop a post-apartheid constitution in a series of small group discussions at the Montfleur Conference Center. But he developed a way of thinking about big problem solving, like a post-apartheid constitution, that level of big problem solving. And he said there's such a thing as tough problems. Tough problems are problems where they're experienced differently. Everybody doesn't experience, we'd all be experiencing the same problem. So, but if the climate is on fire, we're not all experiencing the problem the same way. We don't all experience it. He said, the reality is, tough problems don't usually get solved. Mm-hmm. Usually, we just keep sleepwalking through them all day, for the way that works for me. I really encourage everyone to read what Adam Kahane has to say about the way that we do solve tough problems. And they, so Talanoa, 5 years ago, if you'd looked up Talanoa, you would have negotiations and then people starting to write about, hey, this is an interesting idea. But this, the idea that we have conversations, stories that bring out individual stories, not because somebody's story is better than somebody else's story or somebody has... Catherine and I are both Christians, but you do, all of the faith traditions sort of come down to some basic, broadly shared, deeply held principles, and one of them is every single person's story is of exactly equal worth. So the person who is the vulnerable person in sub-Saharan Africa, and the person who, but their two stories are of exactly the same worth to God, or however we would want to say that. So, storytelling.
Thank you both. Oh my gosh, we already covered so many of the, to this room full of journalists, about what they get right and what they get wrong, about how to cover the nexus of this.
I definitely.
So reporters want to talk to me about the environment and faith because it's like a curiosity. Ooh, even the Christians care about the environment.
Even
the Christians. Or you must have some sort of special way of talking about non-human environmental things because of faith, and that makes you interesting to a story about non-human environmental things. I would say my pro tip to people who aren't in it is not its faithiness at all. It's its communityness. So if faith is what brings me, our faith isn't really probably what's so interesting from our paradigm, and the faith community's paradigm across the world is that it has three core missions. Health, sort of health, and ministry to people who are migrating. So this idea, and that's, I would say, arguably like the very, very, you are a sojourner. So the faith community's attachment to all of the other things that it does kind of stem from these basic things. When you're talking to people in the faith community about climate, be aware that the way they know about climate often is from those activities. So that's my tip.
Great. So I would say there's a few more things to build on what you said, which people don't mind saying, no, I don't want to talk about that. So I would just say ask. Go ahead and ask. Because there's often a lot that you're just hesitant to ask about. The second text uses and perpetuate them. But Christians believe X. They just say, they just accept what the person, often the politician, is right. saying. It's not Christianity. It is moral therapeutic deism. Moral because you have certain standards. Most often for people, it comes from their political ideology. Thou shalt always vote a certain way. Thou shalt adamantly oppose X, Y, and Z. Therapeutic, because it makes you feel better about yourself. And deism, because it's vaguely attributed to a god. Set aside in your own image. So the other side of the coin, from buying and perpetuating the excuses, which then leads people to think, oh, well, that's what Christians do, and that's what people think, and it enhances the us versus them mentality. The other, grew up in public schools, went to public schools, work at a public school. I started to get invitations to speak at Christian colleges. And I thought, in my bias, from what I had heard, that Christian colleges would be, you know, environment or race or justice, and, you know, very adamant about teaching, you know, young earth creationism or whatever it was. And I was so wrong. I have not read a single amazing story about what almost every Christian college I roof, you know, an Anabaptist seminary out of South Bend, Indiana is the first, I think the first seminary to get solar panels. And probably the biggest one in Indiana. New York College, a small Wesleyan college in upstate New York, had the biggest solar array of any others. A lot of relief and development organizations, from World Vision to Plant with Purpose to Tear Fund, are doing amazing work on climate change. World Vision has this guy called Tony Renato, an agronomist from Australia, who has been working with farmers in sub-Saharan Africa on agroforestry for 40 years. Thanks to the simple concept of incorporating trees into their agriculture, he has enabled people to grow enough more food to feed, and I was trying to Google a number really quickly, but I didn't get the number, so don't quote me on this number. But look at the amazing stories of what people are doing from a faith perspective, and again, every faith tradition has these stories, are not being told. Instead, if you go to Google News and you Google, you know, Christian, you are going to get all these political stories about people using Christianity as win. So don't just buy the excuses, but support the counter-narrative, which I feel is, I'm very biased about this, but I feel it's a more genuine narrative, a more genuine expression. Okay, yes. And then lastly, I would say resist the temptation to stereotype. Because this is what I see a lot, is there's a certain, with that stereotype firmly in place.
I'm really critical, and just from my lens, I mean, I did this 9-part series of covering same thing. I just had this, like, I remember, and I've wrote about this in a piece in Orion, where I was sort of trying to personally digest everything that I'd experienced from talking with ranchers in North Dakota, and Georgia peach farmers, and fly fishermen, yes, and dog sledders who are losing in New York City to be at, like, a big swishy thing for the climate, and it was like, and people were like, oh, I had no idea that people bunch of people in New York who really like think that we should be taking climate action, the front lines of climate change, the immediacy, and they were mostly male. And there's also like questions like environmental justice is incredibly important, but just with a very particular lens in mind of what that person looks like, and compassion as it gets lost in that equation. So I think compassion is part of that, and asking people talk, right? We've all experienced that in the field of people. So speaking of opening the doors, so we're back on the record. Yes. Go ahead and go back on the record. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing that personal and everything that you did. But let's open it up to the floor. So basic SEJ protocol, members get priority on questions. Please state your name and affiliation. And, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. So I'm having a very lengthy, deep conversation with the most powerful African-American pastor in our area as a bishop, and we institutional racism in the church that he just thought really, really nailed it. I said, you know, well, I've got to do you a favor, and I'm going to, or just thought really synthesized a lot of things. And with E.O. Wilson's recent passing and everything, he had also, years ago, had started an initiative with the National Press Club trying to, some of the things that he had done years ago to try to get this this movement going.
Oh, yeah.
And the Catholic, because we have, you know, we have Hindus, we have Muslims, we have a big Muslim population in Toledo, and almost every, you're almost hard-pressed to find, you know, a sect of religion that doesn't do something with communications on climate change. And I just wondered if you guys had any thoughts on the impact of E.O. Wilson.
It's less maybe...
is your mic on?
Oh, whoops, sorry. My thought is less on the impact of E.O. Wilson said to my organization. We were, you know, we kind of her and a couple of other sort of hotshot academics and say, you know, we want you to talk to our people about science. And she said, at every small college and university in Texas, there are people who are people of faith. They go to some house of worship in their local community, and they are doing climate science. And it's not fair to not be lifting them up. I think that's the thing. In Flint, Michigan, and in Columbus, and their traditions, and they're also scientists.
Yes.
And it's like faith science roundtable or something like that. And he would be somebody who's right there in Ohio.
He's done really good research. What's his name again? Hitz Hewson.
Yes.
He's done great research even on like what words appeal to people most strongly. And there's no even blanket word that covers the whole Christian community because so for some words, you know, for some stewardship communities are much more powerful than sort of external voices coming up from outside. And we did an experiment. Being a scientist, I run experiments. And I was talking about climate change impacts and solutions. And at three different Christian colleges, out a rapper that explicitly shared that I was a Christian. It turned out that the rapper made no difference. There was a significant most. They all went up to the same level, but the ones who had the furthest to go changed the most. But it didn't matter if I identified as a Christian or not. If the video was presented by that relationship and that local trust, like I live here with you,
right, they would accept it.
Yeah. Overcomes, I could have been anybody, but if they were
super quick. Super quick. Getting back to the purpose of the panel and when Mira had her introduction, I've told a lot of people, and that's how they did. How much does arrogance of a journalist play in this? I mean, are we too arrogant to realize, as you know, as communicators? Because I'm fascinated by this topic from a communication standpoint, and are we too arrogant to recognize that there are other facets of society, whether it's religion or something else, that can help us and complement our efforts to communicate?
Yeah. Oh. 100 million, 1,000 million percent. I mean, I don't know, maybe you know this. I was like, no, do! Like, go tell them about it, because everybody doesn't... I'm sure everybody reads your articles, but most of you maybe that's less true. If you were to approach the faith community so that the book, I'm really proud of it, and I would like you to have it. It's an opening to a relationship. That's what you should want to have it. And I'm going to tell one quick. I know, but you can look at the faith community as a partner. The faith community is what we typically building. They've got a flag. You know, they're planning to be a lawn or hopefully a butterfly garden.
Yeah, exactly.
And if they've done solar or heavens, you know, wind or whatever, like they're really planning to be there. So they want the community to survive. So if they're in Toledo, they sure want the Toledo Blade to survive. So they are not just an interesting source for you. They're a partner for you in how we're going to do that video as a journalist. And he's a particular kind of journalist. He works for public television, and he works on Austin City Limits, which is a little bit different. I know, and as soon as I say that, everybody's like, well, you just stop talking to me. Like, everybody knows what COP 25 is. I said, we interpret what goes on at the COP for the Texas Interfaith Organization. Made a media partnership with the Austin Chronicle, which is the alternative weekly. We got an assignment newspaper in Austin, Texas. You should know it. It's great. This organization to say, we need them to go to Madrid
and get this, those stories for us. And I'm sure you're in one of the videos. So we did daily.
We did videos together.
We did videos together. We did daily videos. We did, and they weren't like particularly so needs though. Paradigm is we know our community. We know the needs, the hopes, aspirations, hopefully. So partner with.
We've got Jim, and then we've got the fellow in the denim, and then we have someone in back.
Hi. So Jim Barker is Inside Climate News. My question relates to a young woman I interviewed in 2020, who's part of the UN. And one of the questions that I asked her was like, "How do you see your future in your church?" Which happened to be Southern Baptist. And I'm just curious if there's been any research or even just polling or whatever about what happens to young climate evangelical activists as they proceed in their life. Do they actually, are they actually making some sort of influence in the church that they grew up in? Or do they have to find some other pathway, like become Unitarian or something?
So there's data, first of all, showing that there's a strong age gradient in levels of concern about climate change. That age gradient is seen in the average population. That age gradient is seen among people who are so wrong in my life is the stereotype that I had of Christian colleges. Students are going to small Christian colleges that are teaching them about climate change and about pollution and about being taught. It is not just a random concern they have they picked up on TikTok. There are educational programs specifically aimed at connecting these two together that literally, I think I've been to one Christian college only that didn't have. Depends on the church. There are all kinds of different churches. The one thing you can say about Christian churches is there's no one church the same as another one. And so there are definitely churches that are theologically conservative, but on issues. I don't want to use the word political because climate change is not a political issue. A thermometer doesn't give you a different answer depending on how you vote, but on social issues, they are very progressive. There's the Sojourners organization led by Jim Wallis that for many years has been beating the drum on social issues from a theological perspective. One of my friends, Jessica Moorman, is a climate scientist whose husband is also a pastor. It's a very small club, but there are multiple where they have staffers from both sides of the aisle who attend their church, and they invited me to give a sermon on climate change a while ago, and they're having a big Earth Day event in a couple of weeks. I was talking about how the church has faced Focal Mind, and he's re-releasing it this year, so wait till it gets re-released. Where he traces from the dawn of the American Revolution when they cut ties with the traditional church structures in England, how religion and politics in the United States has become increasingly interwoven to the point where now, again, religion is, or politics is dictating what religion says. So long answer to the short question, yes, there's places for them to go.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, and you're a member of SUJ?
Awesome. Hi, I'm covering the communities influencing being shaped by science in Atlanta. I am a Christian. I got baptized last year. I currently go to a large mega church, and I'm also a card-carrying member of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. It is waning among my generation. I'm 21. we know that the older generations are more exposed to various to Christianity church culture, that young people are less likely to go to church and more likely to be exposed to various religious faiths, and they're more likely to be atheists too. So how do we talk about faith and climate to help folks that are not necessarily religious understand this paradigm that's playing out across various faith communities across the U.S. and across the world?
I'll answer one way. And then I started my job. You're younger than my youngest child, so I don't know what to say about that. But I was younger than I am now. I started my job 22 years ago, and the year that I started, people said, "Say everybody in the faith community is old," but they're not the same people, because the people who were old, who's a Lutheran minister said, is church always gets people during their golden money bearing years when they're getting scared. People who are young don't participate in their worshiping community. It doesn't mean that they're not formed by information that they get about it. And one of the ways that is the most promising for the future of faith communities in the United States is they don't have to participate in the worshipy part, the faithy part, of the faith community, to participate in the community part of the faith community, go to take communion to plant a tree, right? So.
That's a very good insight. I would also say, as someone who moved to the U.S. when I was just a little bit older than you, in every other country, they have already faced their reckoning. That has already happened in Europe. It is. I'm only saying on this because of culture, and I'm not going to call myself that anymore. That has already happened in Europe. It has already happened in the U.K. It has already happened in Canada. In Canada, if somebody says they're Christian, it means that they are actively involved in a community based on their faith, and they can recite to you exactly why they believe what the United States, as a young person, I very rapidly found out that some people wouldn't recognize what they proclaimed to believe if it bit them in the rear. And so the United States, I think, is the last to face that reckoning that sort of has been refining, I would say, where those anymore, and then what's left is the core of people who are truly people who believe, people who use this to guide their faith. And so because of that, I think there's a lot of people thinking the church is in decline, but I see it as an encouraging thing because I think everybody needs to be who they are. It needs to be genuine and authentic, and if it is not...
Okay, we have one person in the back. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Dave Folsom, Michigan State University, Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. A quick observation and then a question. So we talk a lot on our language. This is like when people like in this room right here hear people say we would like to partner with you, we all cringe because that's the language of corporate America. They all want to partner with us. But the question I have is everybody in this room gets it? They wouldn't be in this room if they didn't realize that it was wonderful. That's just a storytelling here. They decide whether or not they're going to produce what they want to produce. So I guess I'm asking the journalism question. How do you pitch a story like this to an editor? Someone who's rolling their eyes and thinks, says, oh, that's that silly religion stuff. Nobody cares about that.
I'm going to ask Mary to answer that question because that's what your project is all about.
Yeah, it is a struggle. First of all, I want to give a shout out because I didn't mention that RESP has an amazing advisory board. Dave Poulsen serves on it, Catherine Hayes serves on it, so thank you both. But the fellowship originally, two editors, hoping that we could get people in the room to do that. I think the tricky thing is to kind of crowdsource on that resources document that I mentioned on the Religion and Environment Storytelling Project website at, based at BU, Boston University. Stories that worked, and I'm just going to repeat, I think this is fine to repeat this. I had a nice conversation with Kara Buckley of the New York Times on the very first night of this event, and she wrote a story a couple months ago about a person who lives in a suburban landscape who, for creation care religious reasons, is basically turned their suburban lawn into this next-door neighbor person who's a landscaper who has, like, a sheared green fertilized lawn and two shrubs or something like that. What is going on here, right? That's our journalist's little, like, curiosity thing. What is going on here? She finds out it's a religious thing, and this is, like, something that we really stress when we're talking about religion and environment, is to start thinking about these things we think of the term subtle religion and subtle environment. How are people living their lives? But they might be being driven by faith in something that's really important, and they might be acting out their lives in a way that's very environmental. But stop thinking about these terms in their, like, literal capital letter terms. So we're trying to crowdsource those stories. We have Kara's story up there. It was a little bit of a tough sell for her editor, but then when the story went up, she said,
"I
think
it's Kara." Yeah, it was the story. It just seems so obvious. I was like, "It's about a lawn. What is going to happen to this story? Like, will they put it in the? I don't know. Do we still have a leash? But who cares? Because Clint is dead. Sorry, well, maybe it is. He was a Catholic ecologist. I'm sorry, but there was. I think it opened all of our eyes to the possibility of going hyper local in a way. And then, you know, people around, it's like, people have lawns. Like, I forget in New York that people have lawns. A lot of the reader comments showed they were like, God, but this was a Catholic ecologist who believed it was his duty to do this. But, I mean, I didn't expect any of that to happen. But it was eye-opening for me and instructive. And I think just tell them all that story. because they'll get 700,000 pages every time they talk about religion and
Yeah, so those are the mysteries like this.
It wasn't that she wasn't. It was me going, it's about a lawn. And we all know
right.
about pollinators, but the Catholic thing ended up people who didn't know who I was.
Right.
My dog barking at their dog.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you. Thank you so much for adding that. Steve, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just on this point, Steve Rothrop, about 10 years ago, I was writing for CNN for about 4 years on what was called the CNN Belief Blog. There were two reporters, and there was one opinion person, and I was the opinion person. And I was writing, started both the opinion pieces and the religion. And the stories got huge page views and you know, homepage. And eventually, after like a year, every single thing we wrote appeared on the CNN. There were some stories that were getting, you know, 1,000 comments. It wasn't unusual at all.
Yeah.
And so, like, this is to you know, Dave's question. Like, there's a lot of us country. The old way you used to monetize it is the story on Saturday on, you know, it's the religion story, and then it's accompanied by the, you know, the paid church announcements of, you know, go to this church, go to that church. So there, you need editors or, you know, publishers to figure out like how they can monetize these stories, but the eyeballs are really there, and so much of the attention economy that we have now in the journalism space is about these eyeballs, and religion brings them. It just does.
To see this.
Yes.
Let me add my own example to Kara and to Stephen's comments, which is, and this is much smaller scale, this common question, you know, engaging climate, what's happening to hurricanes, and should I just scare the pants off people? Will that make them more? And the objections that we hear, like, the God is in control, the world's going to end anyways, God promised he would never flood the earth again. So we did one episode on what does the Bible say about climate change, and until we started our Science Moms organization last year, and we put the I'm just one kid, what can I do, episode on the Science Moms website. Until then, over the last 4 years, what does the Bible say about climate change was far and away the most viewed episode. Really, I could reply to tweets with.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's there. I think there is. Thanks for those of you who showed up for the religion. Part of it sometimes is that we sort of lack the humanity. I think that that if we can have our own humanity coming through in the stories by recognizing the humanity of the people that we're interviewing. I think that shows, it reveals something. It shows a different side of what is driving people and what scares them and what keeps them up at night and what gives them hope. And to Dee's point, what do they want the future to look like? We should be helping frame some of those questions about what that is going forward. I mean, Amitav Ghosh wrote a wonderful book called The Great Derangement a handful of years ago, I think at this point 7 or 8 years ago, really taking to task artists for not addressing artists of all forms, speculating about what our futures might look like and what it could look like. And that's not just dystopia, that is also, there's room for improvement. And so telling those, find out, this is all, now you have how they're playing out those stories. To your editors to try to help sell them with that. We just have a few more minutes, probably one more question. Oh, yes. Oh, actually, yes. Yes, thank you.
Since I said I was going to pitch.
Yeah.
So we've just done a, this isn't the main thing, right? Always. So this is a primer on the Texas, you may have heard Texas had some electrical problems last February. And now people are sort of sensitized to that. So we've written a primer on what happened, and focus is public health. So rather than vulnerable people, low-income people in any kind of disaster, I hear that I was told that I promised the organizers we would end right at 12:15. It sounds like it is a very packed lunch plenary. Do you have? I know there's a few more questions that maybe you can come up, but last words, being
Ron, I gave some. So
okay,
and go for
us.
Sure. Well, it's so great to be here, and so great to see all this interest in this topic, because stories are, scientists have found, stories hit us right in the heart and help us see ourselves and other people's lived experience, and stories are what change our perspective. And as Mira and I were talking about before this session, everybody comes from different background, different tradition, but around the world, over 85% connect with people is to engage that in our stories. It is not the only thing. It is not necessarily even the, I don't even want to rank the things. But it is a big piece that we sometimes miss when we either sort of accept what's presented. To encourage you to, you've got a couple of concrete stories now on how these things get the most clicks and views. So think about, yes.
We'll help amplify it. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Dave.